Hello and welcome to this week's Radio Dialects. Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Well, welcome to everybody in Bristol and listeners in Preston FM. That's on 103.2 up there in Preston and Birmingham. Hello to you also. We're broadcasting on Unity FM 93.5. Our guest this week is Chris Worthington, ex-Bristol City Council, and we're going to discuss the economic strategies that Bristol City Council will be putting into action and has been over the past few years. Our features this week are by Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Michaela Dennis.
Malcolm Greaves reads the chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Trevor Carter reads one of his poems. And Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and Song of the Week.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Chris Worthington to the studio. Hello.
Hello, John.
So, I understand you've been working for Bristol City Council, but you left in July, but what capacity did you work in?
I worked in the economic development team on quite a wide range of projects, including a support project for businesses in deprived areas of the city, support to businesses in the environmental industries, and dealing with general inquiries to the team from companies that want to relocate to the city.
How did you find working for them? Did it match your expectations, or did you find them wanting?
Oh, it was a great job. I'd recommend having a look at the Invest in Bristol site and you'll get a better idea of Bristol's economy and of what the City Council can do to assist companies to relocate to the area.
One more perception of where Bristol's at economically is that it's dominated by service industries rather than manufacturing. Is that sort of I'm in the right area?
It is doing very well in the service industries, including financial services, with companies like Lloyds TSB, AXA Life and DAS Legal are based here, so there's quite a financial cluster. There's also a big cluster of service industries in accountancy and law, but the economy of Bristol is very diverse.
Do you think Bristol is a bit of an underrated place to base your business? Because it's only 2 hours from London and it's had a lot of wanting for it economically for many years, decades.
It is very successful in economic terms. If you look at the statistics comparing Bristol with other major cities in the UK, such as Nottingham, Sheffield and Leeds, the level of employment here is very high. And on average, the level of unemployment is comparatively low compared with those cities.
So bearing in mind we've obviously had the recession and possibly again with the double dip, how is the challenges that Bristol faces unique, do you find?
We've lost some jobs in the service industries, we've lost some jobs in financial services, but fortunately Bristol's economy is very diverse, with a lot of jobs in high-tech manufacturing and aerospace. For instance, Airbus now employ 4,000 people in the city. And during the time I was with Bristol City Council, I dealt with a contractor to Airbus that were going to create another 40 jobs. We also have a lot of IT companies, such as Toshiba have their European Research Centre here, and Orange also have a major facility here.
Okay, but did you interact at all with Cadbury in their famous factory closure at all?
We didn't, because actually it will have an impact on the Bristol economy. Although it's some distance, the factory in Keynsham is some distance from Bristol city centre, and it's actually in the adjacent authority of Bath and North East Somerset.
Yes,
but yes, it will have an impact.
Yeah. How does Avonmouth factor in? For a lot of people who just live and work in Bristol city centre, it's probably a bit of an unknown quantity, but how important is Avonmouth to Bristol's economy?
Avonmouth's very important. Having the port there is very good for some industries, and it's a major employer in itself in the city. A lot of the employment land that's been taken up in recent years has been in the Avonmouth port area, and during the time that I was with Bristol City Council, we had about 10 planning applications from companies that were involved in renewable energy in the port area. So it's a huge opportunity.
A lot of news from a lot of companies is that the banks are still not lending. Are you finding that in terms of developing Bristol's economy problematic?
I think it depends on the sector. We found there was plenty of opportunity for investment in growth industries, such as renewable energy and the environmental industries. It's possibly more difficult in other areas.
Environmental stuff is probably in the minority of most businesses, wouldn't you say?
I think that's correct, yeah.
So a lot of people are still having a lot of problems.
Yeah, one of the things we did during the time I was at the council was to set up a new loan fund for small businesses in the city with help from the Regional Development Agency and the European Union.
Okay. Why is the state of the Bristol City Council's balance sheet so poor, aside from obviously having had a recession?
I think this is part of a broader question. I don't think personally that local authorities have enough control over their own finances within the government's structure for local government finance. We're not really allowed to keep enough of the money raised in the local tax.
So greater autonomy, you think, would benefit you?
Greater autonomy would definitely be a step in the right direction.
A lot of people were really keen when John Prescott kept trumpeting how he really wanted more power to be outsourced. Are you generally disappointed by New Labour's record?
I don't think they made much progress in that direction of giving more autonomy to the local government. We look towards the new government to do that, and that's one of the things which they are setting out plans for at the present time. I hope those plans come to fruition.
Okay, so they're giving you promising words, as a lot of people often do, but judgment is yet to be announced then.
I think that's about right.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about creative industries, because Bristol is sort of famed for being a bit anarchic, a bit creative, a bit edgy. What is the state of the media and creative industries?
It's very buoyant. There are a lot of small and medium-sized businesses in the creative industries. There are some very substantial and well-known companies in those industries, such as Hardman Animation. The BBC have their natural history unit based here, so there's a lot of skills have been developed in those larger companies. We did support some of that through the council. Hardman actually are a sponsor of our Invest in Bristol website, and we provided support to small and medium-sized enterprises in the creative industries through grant aid to a networking organisation called Bristol Media.
How could developing links with growth industries benefit the Bristol City Council's balance sheet? How do you think that could work?
Well, this is where we don't have control over our local taxation. The additional business rates that are collected from business, from the growth of new businesses or the relocation of existing businesses, does not come direct to the council. It goes to the government and then is dispersed throughout the country through the uniform business rate system.
Okay. What interaction with house prices do you have? Bristol's house prices are usually very high. What is the property industry like here?
It varies a lot across the city. There are, as in many cities, there are areas of lower cost housing and some areas of very high cost housing comparable with London. I think there are opportunities there for people who want to relocate, particularly from London, to do that and secure a very good quality of life. And that's in fact the reason why many people move here.
How are you finding the cuts in Westminster are affecting Bristol City Council? How does that filter down to economic development in a local area?
Well, we've got a number of major government agencies here, including the Environment Agency, and as those cuts filter down, there is likely to be a loss of public sector jobs outside of the local council. So that is a concern.
Were you hoping possibly that a more Labour strategy of continuing to spend might carry on rather than the cuts that we've got now in terms of local economic
development? My own view is there should be less cuts in public spending to sustain economic growth.
There are a lot of big businesses, but what is it like for small and medium businesses, and what can the economic development team do to help?
I think that Bristol's a good place to start a business. I mentioned the growth in creative industries and in the environmental industries, where there are opportunities for new start businesses and for small businesses to expand. And there's a buoyant service sector that creates demand in the local economy for all sorts of businesses. So I would say that it's a good time to start a business, even though we are probably coming out of a recession, and there's plenty of support available within this city for new start businesses.
Okay, so you don't think that a double-dip recession is so likely in your estimation?
Well, I think Bristol's weathering the recession very well. We're doing better than most other cities in the UK, and in that sense, again, it's a good time to start a business, and there's plenty of help available, including support for businesses in deprived areas that I mentioned, okay, where we've got some European money.
What's helped us in terms of weathering the recession most? How have we managed to escape the worst of the recession?
I think the diversity in the local economy, the fact we've got high-skilled jobs here, we've got two very good universities, and we've got spit-out businesses from those universities through incubator centres in the universities that are helping to set up new high-tech jobs.
OK, well, what sort of feedback have you had from small businesses that are trying to set up in terms of how you've been able to help them?
We work very closely with the national organisation Business Link that is funded by the government to provide support to new and established businesses. And for anyone starting a business, I would recommend go to the Business Link website. There's a huge amount of information there. We work very closely with them.
Do you think there are greater opportunities for manufacturing as well, rather than relying solely on creativity, particularly in Berrymore and Avonmouth and its importance?
One key element in manufacturing is the skills that are needed. And again, the universities are very important in that, and they're developing very good links with manufacturing companies in the area, okay, particularly growth industries such as renewable energy.
We've got quite a lot of academic institutions here, but how do you find vocational qualifications in terms of Bristol education and how that can help develop the economy?
We've got a very good new further education college, City of Bristol College, which is a merger of the smaller further education colleges that existed in the city previously. Yeah. That's gaining a very good reputation.
Okay, well, if people are interested in finding out any more about this, how can they get in touch with the economic development team, particularly if they're a small business or whatever?
Look at the Invest in Bristol website, contact the economic development team, contact Business Link. If you're starting a business, get some advice and think about going on a training course.
All right, well, Chris Worthington, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, Bristol has one of the richest heritages of local history of any city in Europe, and in the 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones is author of the fascinating book Bristol Curiosities, and Dialect's Tony Gosling continues his conversations with Julian about Bristol's hidden history. This week, Julian takes us on a tour around the historic city walls of Bristol.
That area where you started, around Temple Church and Sperry, has changed a tremendous amount over the years. We've got a map here of the area in 1755. And actually, Victoria Street is quite a new addition, isn't it?
Yes, well, we tend to think now that if you go back to the 18th century, getting in and out of Bristol was quite convoluted. I mean, now we blame the traffic. In the 18th century, they still blame the traffic, but there were no direct routes. I mean, for example, when you were coming in from Bath, coming to the centre of Bristol, the old centre, the Wine Street, High Street, Carfax, you had to get across Bristol Bridge, which was narrow. I mean, before the 18th century, you had a chapel in the middle of it, and you had houses like the old London Bridge hanging over the edge. But there was no direct road. You came through the narrow Temple Gate, which was a classic city gate with a wide arch for the carriages and two smaller arches on either side for the pedestrians. And then you worked your way up through Temple Street. Then you had to cut across through a maze of narrow streets and overhanging tenements. It wasn't a direct road to Bristol Bridge as it is now. Then you had to negotiate the hump of Bristol Bridge. There were trace horses there to help, which would be added to the wagon to help get the carriage, the cart, over the hump of Bristol Bridge. And this is why, if you look on the old directories, you'll find the area around, which is now a sort of almost an open wasteland, around Three Queens Lane, Mitchell Lane, and around there towards Redcliffe end of St Thomas Street. That's where all the hauliers and cartiers were for the taking goods through to Somerset and the other surrounding counties, because they couldn't get really any closer to the old city than that. And you had the same thing if you think coming up Colston Street. Now you just go straight up to Colston Street and then go up to St Michael's Hill. Colston Street, there was Steep Street, which cut sort of diagonally through there, and that was the passage to Aust. So you had to go up through there and negotiate St Michael's. I mean, I've always thought that St Michael's on the Mount without is probably because you were without breath by the time you got there.
What remains are there then of the original city walls, and whereabouts did they go? Because as far as I can think now, the only one is at the bottom of, is it Broad Street now?
Yes, that's the city wall. But you had at St John's on the Arch, you can see the portcullis groove in the arch. And what is interesting, when I was researching, nothing to do with Temple History Group, when I was researching for my book a couple of years ago on Bristol Curiosities, ferreting around with the church's permission up in the Tower of St John's, I actually came across two of the portcullis chains that are still there, hidden away, and they've been completely forgotten about for couple hundred years, 300 years. But yes, there's that small bit of church wall there. That is the only bit above ground now. I mean, there are other evidence. I mean, over the last 20, 30 years, the city, the museum and archaeologist, Bob Jones, they've been digging. There's the Port Wall Lane, which is because it is the port wall. And then you have Tower Harrods, which is where Bristol and West is now at Temple Quay. And that was a large round redoubt. It was also a gunpowder store at one stage, which did cause some alarm to the residents and the church authorities. And then in King Street, in the Burton's Arms houses, in there is the remains of one of the city wall foundations you can see. So that is sort of below ground, but it is opened up so you can see the remains of it. And those are really the only visible things. But there is a more tangible evidence of it. If you go to St John's, go down Broad Street to Bell Lane or Tower Lane. If you go down to Broad Street, turn right, you turn into Tower Lane, which curves around to your right. You carry on through until you come up to the Pitay. And if you get to the Pitay and you then turn back along Wine Street, go down the High Street, go along St Nicholas Street, which curves, and the steps going down from St Nicholas Street, the two flights of steps, one by the church of St Nicholas and another one a bit further along by the pub, what was the fish market, that is the thickness of the city wall. And if you carry on along St Nicholas Street, again curving to your right, cross over Corn Street, right opposite you is a very dark opening, which is St Leonard's Lane. And because the parish, the church of St Leonard's was at the bottom there. And if you carry on along Leonard's Lane and you go right the way through this narrow, dark lane, and you come out through a hauling way at the bottom of Small Street. And if you just before you come out through an arched opening, because it's going under the buildings, much like I mentioned earlier on about the problems they had in Waters Lane, getting the stuff out of the works. And if you look on the left-hand side of the wall there, you'll find deep grooves cut in the wall, about 4 inches deep. And these are because when the carts used to come through there, they tilted on the camber and dragged themselves along the wall. And they've actually made these huge grooves in the brickwork, which is why a lot of the curbs have got iron castellated edging to actually protect the walls from the carts. Anyway, if you carry on across Small Street, you'll find the opening of Bell Lane. If you carry on through Bell Lane, again curving round to the right, it'll bring you back to St John's Church, and you have walked the outline of the old city, the medieval city walls. But then outside that was another ring of walls built later as Bristol expanded, which, say, went down through King Street and up through Lewin's Mead and then out Lawford's Gate and right the way around.
What was the point of these walls? Who were they there to keep out?
Two things. One, you had to be a burgess or a freeman to trade, and you had to be a member of this a city. You had to own property in the city. You were actually protecting the city. I mean, Bristol was a border town. It was a border between Mercia and Wessex and all of that lot from the south. I mean, there were permanent arguments, not open warfare, as far as I'm aware, between, for example, the burgesses of Bristol and the burgesses of Redcliffe, because Redcliffe at one stage could have overtaken Bristol as the premier town, the largest port, and the richest. Especially remember that Canning's, who was the second largest ship owner and merchant to the king in the 1300s, and as a Baltic trader, in fact he's the only person who was allowed to trade in the Baltic at that time, and there was the defence from outlaws. All right, you didn't build walls like this just to protect you from outlaws, but Bristol was always a strategic outpost. I mean, the number of kings and various other people that were imprisoned here between being carted off. And then you had the wars between Stephen and Matilda, and they all occupied Bristol Castle, voluntary or otherwise, at one stage or other. So it was important. And then, of course, coming up to the modern days, up to the Civil War, 1600s, I mentioned about the portcullis for St John's. I mean, it was very important. I mean, the Royalists were bombarding the city. You had Prince Rupert, and you had forts on Prior's Hill at the top of, you had Nine Tree Hill, you had forts behind QEH on the water fort running down there on Brandon Hill, and you had this ring of forts. There's evidence even today. Well, there's two bits of evidence. One is if you go up Queen's Road, just between the museum and the wall going up to what is now Brown's, it used to be the refectory, you'll find there's a big brass plate on the wall there saying about this was Washington's breach, where Colonel Henry Washington broke through the defences of Bristol near there. And more interestingly, recently in my old school, QEH, we used to have some rather odd shot-putting balls in the back of the sports cupboard that were never used. I'm going back to 1950s now, mid-50s. But recently, in the upper yard, they actually found something that blocking one of the drains, and they fished it out, and it was another one of these balls, and they've now since identified what we're using as shot-putting balls were, in actual fact, Civil War cannon that had been fired from the either fired from or at the redoubt on the top of Brandon Hill, which we've been gladly using them as shot-putting. So that's why Bristol had to have walls around it.
Julian Lee Jones there talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about how easily we seem to forget our local history and also the city's historic walls. More local history from Julian next week. Temple Local History Group's website is at history4u, and that's the number 4.info. Following the folk theme, we're going to be playing a track from the CD Ghost from the Basement, recorded at the vaults of the Village Thing in 1970 to 1974, an album of lost songs, dreams and folkadelia. This one's called Good to Cry by Lackey and Sweeney.
That was Good to Cry by Lackey and Sweeney. Our next feature by Anthea Page. Unfortunately, we ran out of time last week, so we're going to hear it now. That's the second part of an interview with Luca, recorded in a cafe bar in Balchik in Bulgaria. This week, Luca tells us how living under a communist regime after World War II had a big impact on his family, who were living at the time in the capital, Sofia.
How were you affected by the communist era, your family?
My father was thrown out of the university and wasn't allowed to graduate the university, and because of this fact he had to work and support a family without fulfilling his dreams. My grandfather was put to prison because he was a king's officer, and no matter if he participated in two wars, the second was the First World War, and in fact he was an honest king's officer. After 1944 he was put in prison and they were about to kill him, but anyway it so happened that he survived. Many people were in this position after 1944.
What happened to your family? Did they take over your house?
I always, at least I try to see the funny side of things. Our family house, the house of my grandfather and his brother, was nationalized by the communists. And when this house, this big house was erected, was built up, the house was envisaged for two families to live in. When the communists came to power in 1944, they nationalized the house, they took the house, and they accommodated 12 families in our house.
Were you still there then, or did they move you somewhere else?
My grandfather, my grandmother, my father and his sister, they were left to live there, but they had to pay a small... I cannot say if it was small in those years, in the 50s. They had to pay money to the municipality for living in their own house and sharing their own house with 12 different families. The reason is that our family, me, my father's family, me, my mother and father, in fact, we shared the apartment of the first floor. We shared it with another family, and if me as a small child had to use the toilet, I had to go after midnight in the other part of the apartment, because the toilet was in this part of the apartment where the other family lived, and if they didn't unlock the door, I couldn't go to the toilet.
Did you like the other families, though? Because it wasn't their fault, was it, in a way? They were put there by the communists.
Some of them were nice people. What they did, I mean, the regime did, not to our family, but to most of the people that had own houses and land. What they did was to, especially when it came to the houses, they accommodated communist members in our house and later gave them apartments behind our houses. They built up apartments for these party members, militia guys. They built apartments for them, and some communist families in fact used our house as a jumping point to go to their private apartments later. I mean, they paid almost nothing to be as tenants in our house, and then they were given apartments by the state. But my father and mother, they had to save money for nearly 20 years to buy an apartment of our own, and we left the house in the 70s and had our own flat in a block of flats, in a block of prefabricated flats. Unfortunately, we couldn't take my grandfather's and his brother's house back when democracy returned in 1989.
Was it depressing then?
The most depressing thing, at least to some people, was that we couldn't say what we think. Or if you say what you really think about the system, and that if you say you didn't like the system, you would have been sent to prison, you'd have been thrown out of the university, you would have been not let to take exams in the university, or whatever. There were the communists were placing different obstacles in front of everyone who wanted to oppose them.
Were you aware of a secret police at any point?
Yes. What they did, the communists, were to recruit average common people and use them as snitches. And many people, especially some writers or journalists or actors, they unfortunately were forced to become informers of the political militia.
Did you know anyone in your neighbourhood who became an informer?
Some people, yeah.
That must have been very difficult for you, knowing that neighbours were betraying.
I didn't realize how crucial it could be. But later in my life, I found out that some of my closest friends were, in fact, informers of the political militia. Some of them, they informed on me, on some colleagues.
Is that why you didn't qualify as a doctor?
Not really. I blame it on me, because, to be honest with you, in the next three, 4 or 5 years, I could have renovated my exams. We had this opportunity. But I'm trying to give you at least part of the whole picture. In fact, most of the people who didn't agree with the system and who opposed the system, no matter how modest were their opposition, they weren't given any chance to develop themselves in the field of science or anything. Of course, we have lovely, unique people, and they deserve their high status nowadays because they were very stubborn and they are very knowledgeable people. But at the same time, most of them had to make some compromises in order to go on developing their career, no matter if it was a scientific career or a judicial career or any career.
What happened in 1989?
The Communist Party suddenly, for one night, became Democratic Party. They gave the sack of the Prime Minister, the Communist leader, who was ruling over the country for nearly 40 years. And we had this impression, or we were hypnotized to think that it's over with the communist regime, the democratic times had come. But in fact, the communists mimicked that they were the ones to lay down the new foundations of a democratic state, so to say. They mimicked this, and from communists, they became capitalists. And they privatized most of the biggest part of the Bulgarian industry or banking or whatever.
Did this have anything to do with any external things that were happening in Europe at the time?
Nothing of this would have happened if there wasn't this Soviet leader, Gorbachev. Things changed in Bulgaria, not because people were ready to sacrifice their lives to get rid of the communist system, but things changed in Bulgaria because it was the spirit of this year, so to say. I mean, if the change didn't come from the Soviet Union, not would have happened here.
You said earlier, but not on this interview, that you were a fan of Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, yeah.
Why is that then? Because she's not very popular in England.
I know that she's not very popular in England, but she's very popular with people like me here. Because she, at least this is my standpoint, no one but she and Ronald Reagan, the American president, they brought the communist system down to its knees, definitely. She may not have been so popular in Britain, but she helped these 7 or so countries to get rid of the communism because she joined the American president Ronald Reagan, she joined the American way of dealing with the ex-Soviet Union, so that they blocked most of the opportunities of the Soviet Union in the economical field. So the Soviet Union, as the communist system, is never a productive system. The communist system is parasitic system. The communist system is like tick. And Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, God bless them, they knew exactly how to force, or at least how to make Soviet Union to loosen its grip on these 7 ex-socialist countries. And I definitely admire what they said at this time, that it was an empire of evil, because the evil was there. And even now, I think the nowadays even situation there gives birth to strange evil creatures that unfortunately are still in command there. No matter how smart and how intelligent Russians are in general, but unfortunately it so happens there. I don't know why, but they poisonous mushrooms appear again. Even nowadays, countries should be very careful about Russia and the regime there, because one never knows what is going to come out of it again. It's strange, such an intelligent nation to produce such dictators, would-be dictators, I don't know.
That was Anthea Page. Thank you very much to her for talking to Luca in Belgic, Bulgaria, about the communist regime which came to power after World War II.
Now we have Malcolm Greaves, who's going to read another instalment of Secrets and Lies.
Secrets Secrets and Lies, leaked by David Southwell. If someone hits you with a cricket bat, you can usually see it coming. You can certainly feel it straight away, and you have a pretty good idea of the kind of damage that's going to be inflicted. However, not all of the side effects of mankind's dangerous toys are quite so clear-cut. One of the most insidious must be nuclear fallout. Even if it's from a bomb, you can't see the fallout, and its effects may not manifest themselves for years. Of course, these facts make it much easier for governments to lie about fallout in the first place, to pretend it didn't happen, and to lie about its effects. As a child born in the 1970s, when man was still going to the moon, the exploration of space has always seemed to me one of humanity's greatest accomplishments. One of the few benefits of the Cold War was that it provided the fuel of political pride for the space race. Unfortunately, the fuel used to power many satellites was nuclear. While the rockets used to power space missions are non-nuclear, missions often contain nuclear payloads, and many satellites use plutonium-238 as fuel, in the form of a long-lasting battery known as a radioisotope thermal generator. Although plutonium-238 does explode, during its half-life of 87.8 years, it is 270 times more radioactive than the plutonium-239 used in nuclear weapons. It's not a substance conducive to human health. This makes the several spacecraft mishaps that have resulted in plutonium-238 being released into the atmosphere extremely worrying. There is not the space to detail even a fraction of the accidents that have occurred, but a typical example is that of a 1964 US navigational satellite which failed to attain orbit after takeoff. The nuclear-powered satellite broke up as it fell back to Earth, releasing 2.1 pounds of plutonium-238 into the atmosphere. According to Dr. John Goffman, Professor of Medical Physics at the University of California at Berkeley, this accident alone led to an increase in global lung cancer rates. Of course, the US authorities didn't exactly promote this information, and details of many satellite mishaps remain secret. In 1985, author Carl Grossman got NASA to admit that there was a very small risk of releasing plutonium-238 in its missions, but that the odds were 100,000 to 1 against, due to the high reliability inherent in the design of the space shuttle. Within weeks of saying this, the Challenger shuttle exploded. The next space shuttle mission was due to carry a payload of 24.2 pounds of plutonium-238. Scientists estimate that 24 pounds of plutonium-238 released into the atmosphere could have resulted in several million deaths. Plutonium-238 may feature in many of NASA's future planned missions. In the 1950s, the British people were sold a lie by the government. They were informed nuclear power was being introduced to provide cheap and clean power. The real reason was that a nuclear power program was needed if the British were to build their own nuclear bomb. However, the biggest nuclear lie the public was told was that nuclear power was safe. On October the 8th, 1957, at the Windscale nuclear plant on the Cumbrian coast of England, a heat sensor failure led to a fire in the Windscale Pile No. 1 reactor. 2 days later, air samplers picked up high levels of radioactivity, which led staff to realise one of their reactors had been blazing for 2 days, carrying plumes of radioactive material out of a chimney. With temperatures rising at 20 degrees a minute, staff had a stark choice: risk meltdown or risk an explosion by dousing the pile with water. They used water, and the gamble paid off. Even with this close scrape, the Windscale fire was the world's worst nuclear power disaster of its time. Windscale Pile No. 1 was not just generating electricity, it was producing plutonium for use in British bombs. The fire released radioactive material including tellurium-132, cesium-137, strontium-90, polonium-210 and iodine-131, in a nuclear cloud that drifted over England and as far across Europe as Denmark. As iodine-131 easily enters the food chain, millions of litres of milk from an area of 250 square miles surrounding Windscale had to be poured away during the following 4 months. Prime Minister Harold Macmillan classified almost all details of the fire for 30 years to try and quell public fears. he ordered a massive pro-nuclear power publicity campaign and that the medical impact of the disaster should be downplayed. Later expert investigations suggest that the accident claimed more than 1,000 lives, mainly through cancer. Between 1950 and 1997, there were 194 accidents at Windscale, 11 involving fires, and 45 that led to plutonium releases. Details of many of these incidents remain classified. It seems that, like radioactive isotopes, lies have half-lives and can take a very long time to decay. At the present time, the thing France is most famous for sinking in the Pacific is the Greenpeace ship, Rainbow Warrior. The boat was planning to breach the exclusion zone around Mururoa Atoll when, on July 10, 1985, agents from the French intelligence service DGSE planted two bombs aboard the ship that sank it and killed one of its crew. Soon the French could be responsible for sinking a whole island as a result of their nuclear tests, rather than a single ship, as it has emerged that there is an increasing risk that the whole of Mururoa Atoll could collapse into the ocean. The French government continues to keep secret the nature and long-term impact of the 178 nuclear bombs it exploded on Mururoa and Fangataufa atolls between 1966 and 1996. However, the French Atomic Energy Commission admitted in 2001 that we are observing an acceleration of the natural seaward progression of certain perimeter areas in the northeastern zone. There has definitely been a weakening of the atoll rock that has been amplified by the nuclear tests. Putting this into plain English, the former test site is crumbling, and there is a strong chance that the atoll could collapse. This is in complete contrast to the French position before 1996, when they ridiculed suggestions by environmentalists saying the same things and accused them of being liars. Even in the face of photographic evidence of fissures, subsidences and slides gathered by campaigners, the French government continued to lie. In 1995, it even threatened to sue Le Monde when it printed a leaked map showing various cracks and fissures on Mururoa. A collapse could cause a catastrophic tsunami, wiping out thousands of lives across the Pacific area. Huge amounts of radioactive materials will be released into the ocean. An expert on the atoll, Nick McClellan, believes that much of the plutonium would be dispersed. But gaining accurate information is difficult due to continuing French secrecy and its classification of the island as a national defence protected zone.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve there, straight out of Swindon, and thank you also to David Southwell, who wrote Secrets and Lies, and also for letting us read it out on the air.
The Interactive Games Festival is now in its third year. It's back again on Friday the 17th and Saturday the 18th of September. The festival is a two-day event which uses the streets of Bristol as a giant playground where new and innovative games are organised and everyone is invited to get involved. The majority of the games are taking place in the city centre and there's something for everyone, even if you're a mere spectator. I caught up with the festival director Simon Johnson to hear more about the games in this year's festival and to find out more about interactive games and why we should be playing. Okay, it's Michaela Dennis here. I'm here with Simon Johnson, who is the Festival Director of IGFest. Hi, Simon.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. So tell me about your involvement with IGFest.
Okay, so IGFest is the Interesting Games Festival, and we set it up 3 years ago now, and I'm the Festival Director.
So what is IGFest? One thing that lots of people have been saying, it's like having the city as your playground. Like, how does that actually work in reality?
Yeah, good question. It is very much like having the city as your playground. So we set up a set of games. We get game designers to bring their games internationally. So we have a whole bunch of different games flying in, which should enable you to play in some quite unusual ways across the city throughout the festival.
So give me an example of that. Say IGFest is coming up in a couple of weeks' time. What was one of your favourite games that's going to come up from that?
There's quite a broad range of games at the festival. So we've got our headline game, which is called 2.8 Hours Later, mm-hmm. which is a giant citywide zombie chase game. And that's on for two nights on the 17th and the 18th. And it's like 200 players a night. And, you know, multiple performers, multiple locations. It's going to be pretty good.
So it's basically going to be like Shaun of the Dead, but in real life, and you're a character, and you're terrified and being chased by zombies.
Yeah, exactly. So if you've ever wanted to live out your life in a zombie apocalypse, here is your best chance.
Wow, that sounds terrifying, but also pretty cool. Are the games free generally, or do people have to pay?
The headline game is ticketed, and you can get tickets from Watershed, but the rest of the festival is entirely free.
And whereabouts is the festival actually being held? Is it in the very centre?
Yeah, Eggfest 3 is right in the centre of Bristol, so we're based on St Nicholas Street, which is in St Nicholas Market.
And are most of the games being held there, or are they kind of all over the city?
The games themselves are all over the city, so all the games start here. So if you want to play, come down to St Nick's Market on the day, and you'll find us in the street. We've got a whole bunch of fun stuff happening in the street. And sign up for any of the games you want, and we'll take you off to the game start location.
Have you got any other particular games that you think are going to be highlights that people should make a beeline for?
There's lots of things. There's a game called The Hat Game, which is one of our games, but it's the first time it's being played in this country, so we're quite pleased to bring it here. Hat Game is a kind of GPS hunt for a hat. So we've got a bowler hat, which we've put a GPS device in, and we set it loose in the city, and you can try and hunt down the hat. If you find somebody wearing the hat, you walk up to them and say, "I do believe you have my hat." At which point they have to take their hat off and give it to you, and then it's your turn, and people will be hunting you across town to try and take the hat from you.
So hide and seek with a bowler hat, basically, in the city.
Hide and seek with a GPS bowler hat.
What happens if you don't want to be running around with a bowler hat in the city? What happens if you want to be a bit more of a spectator? Like, what different roles can people play in the different games that you've got available?
There's lots of games you can just turn up and watch. A lot of the games create quite an amazing spectacle. For example, we've got a game called Jeff's Jousting, which is, it's kind of an interpretation of jousting using mini bikes and foam lances. So that's going to be fantastic, but again, it'll be fantastic just to turn up and watch that. And there's going to be a number of games going on throughout the day that you can turn up and see what's happening. Some of the games are pretty short and last just a few minutes. Some of the games last hours. Some of them are high tech, some of them don't use any tech at all. So there's pretty much games for anybody, any age.
Are they generally quite physical? You have to come prepared, like in trainers, ready to go, like running around the city. I mean, not for all of them, I suppose, but there's a kind of element of getting involved, absolutely.
Again, they're very much interactive games. So the games will lead you out of the city and let you play in quite unusual ways, ways you may not have thought you could play before, and in places you might not be able to play. But we've got a game, one of our favourite games from some of the festivals in the past was a game called Snakes and Blaggers, which is kind of like a game of Snakes and Ladders, but you play in a multi-storey car park. Mm-hmm. So you go up the stairs and down the slopes. So I think one of the most important things about Eggfest is it's about claiming public spaces to play. And Eggfest lets you play in public spaces in ways you can't do otherwise.
That's pretty cool. And so where's the idea of these interactive game festivals come from originally then?
It came from New York, actually. The first of the citywide games festivals started in New York about 5 years ago. That's called Come Out and Play. They're still going strong. And I was lucky enough to be at one of the early festivals. So that got the ball rolling. So 3 years ago, we set up kind of laboratory, like the world's first pervasive games lab, where we started playing around with different kinds of games you can play in the city. Mm-hmm. And that just mushroomed pretty quickly into the first festival, and then the second, and now the third. So yeah, 3 years in, Eggfest 3, bigger, better, badder than ever.
That sounds amazing. And are there lots of games that are created by people in Bristol?
I think one of the nice things about Bristol is that there's a really strong creative community, but we're quite a small city. So there's a lot of people in Bristol who get involved. But because we're a small city, we still need to look outside of ourselves. So actually, the festival is an international games festival. So we've got people coming from as far away as New York and Serbia and Austria. I don't think the New Zealand guys are coming this year. But yeah, so every year we have multiple international game designers bringing pretty much the world's best street games here to Bristol.
Obviously, there must be a lot of work that goes behind this. So have you got partners that help you out with these kind of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year, we've got a number of fantastic sponsors. We've teamed up with the Bristol Cycle Festival. And we've got a whole host of cycling-related games taking place throughout the day. And our big headline game, 2.8 Hours Later, is sponsored by the Bristol Film Office and Southwest Screen.
Pretty big players.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to get people involved. And the council have, as ever, been a fantastic asset to us. So Bristol City Council, I won't hear too many bad things said against them. Mm-hmm. They've been an amazing partner for us throughout the 3 years of the festival.
Absolutely. And I suppose you're wanting to get bigger and better with each year that goes by. So it's definitely really, really important to have that kind of support there.
Yeah, I think ongoing relationships with the city's institutions are super important to us. But moreover, because we get to do so much fun stuff because of them. And yeah, every year gets bigger, and this year's fantastic. Next year's going to be incredible.
So do you find lots of people from like previous years tell all their friends and bring them along?
Yeah, I think that because Eggfest is kind of an unusual activity or set of activities, I think most people don't know what it is. So people who've been in the previous years, they're our best advocates. anybody who comes to one festival returns the next year.
So where can people find out more? Is there a website that people can take a look at?
Yeah, so to find out more, just go to igfest.org. So that's igfest.org. All the information about the festival is up online there.
Well, you heard all the details there about getting involved in IGFest. Thank you very much, Simon, for talking me through it.
Thanks very much. Hope to see you at the festival. Hope to see you all out there playing.
That was Simon Johnson, the festival director at IGFest. The festival takes place on the 17th and 18th of September. All games take place in the city centre. And to find out more, go to www.igfest, that's IGFEST.org.
It's my pleasure to introduce Trevor Carter. Hello.
Hi there, John.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm soldiering on.
Good, good.
Yeah.
What have you got for us?
Well, I've noticed Mr. Blair's been in the news again with the publication of his book.
Hmm.
So I thought I would share a few thoughts on Tony Blair. So it's kind of obituaries for his political legacy, which is an astonishing achievement, really. Blair, smiley, wily, debonair, oh, what gravitas, oh, what flair. Yeah, Blair was our national chair. Teflon-coated, there's nothing he could not repair. He'd reassure as he walked on air. Yeah, yeah, that was Blair. He said we'd all get rich and get our share. That's how he ensnared us, did Tony Blair. Some said, bloody liar, yeah? He sent our boys off over there to fight in desert wards and dare to say it was all right and fair. And then repeat it with a manic stare. He led us into deep despair. Yeah, that was our boy, oh, Tony Blair. He never went to Weston-super-Mare, but had friends on Francis Riviera. Yet for all his faults, beyond compare, unscathed and undefeated, yeah? He'd never be a Mr. Bean, a bumbling bear, a sorry scene, a clunking fist in pseudo-green. Nah, not Blair. He always was a pro, you know. His smile could glance off any blow. He dazzled in the media glare, was clever and had style to spare, could sparkle just like Fred Astaire, not like his nominated heir, Mr. Brown, the bumbling bear. Now he's got another job somewhere. He's become a multi-millionaire, giving speeches and consulting. Yeah. Still, although he made some people swear his talent is supremely rare, he has survived the wear and tear. Don't you agree? Fair's fair. Yeah. There'll never be another Blair. Now, Tony Blair's wrote a book, and some readers who have had a look say it's not true what's written there. But that's not surprising. To be fair. And so, perhaps, I leave it there.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that. Has he survived the wear and tear? He does look extremely haggard these days. Do you know? A bit of skeletal edge.
I think he looks really good.
Yeah.
I wish I looked like that.
Oh, I think you look better than Tony Blair, to be honest. You're
too kind, John. Too kind.
Your handsome features and shiny, colourful shirt are always welcome here.
Yeah. Thank you.
So when is your next cabaret, maybe ask?
The next cabaret is on Friday the 1st of October.
And what can people expect of a cabaret if they're uninitiated?
Well, I've got a promotional poem. When you're feeling indecisive, when you're neither out nor in, when your world appears derisive, when you feel that you can't win, when your vocal cords are tongue-tied and you've nothing left to say, when you're sitting on the outside and no one has come out to play. Do not dwell on your dilemmas. Do not think, what use is this? Forget about those passing tremors. Consider my hypothesis. We are enriched by entertainment that sees life in a different mode. It makes us ponder our arrangement as we meander our life's road. Our circus is an inspiration. Perhaps you've seen us in the news. Our music is a sound sensation to medicate a recession blues. Jokey stand-ups mock pretensions about the things we do and see. Poets offer new dimensions, as versatile as verse can be. Magicians are a source of wonder, tricks to amuse you and amaze. So missing out would be a blunder. The cabaret is set to blaze! Yeah.
And all of that was off by heart, I'll have you know, out there in listener land. Off by heart, I tell you. What is the number if people want to get a ticket?
0117
0117
966
966
5514
5514. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
And it's my pleasure to welcome Jeff Sparks for the What's On. Hello.
Hello, John. Good afternoon. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 17th of September, and Zen Elephant will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. On to Saturday, 18th of September, Citizen Fish will be performing with support from A-Heads and also Spanner at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7.50 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Anubis Spire. This group formed in USA in 1998 and to date have released 2 studio albums and 2 compilation albums. This is from the most recent studio album, Children of a Foreign Faith, which was released in 2007. There's a track titled Western Wall.
There's a fire that keeps on burning all along the Western Wall. There's a nightmare keeps returning, and it makes no sense at all. Out in the street, the heat is rising. Down at the checkpoint, voices scream. There's smoke on the horizon. Just enough to fuel your dreams. No more sorrow, no more struggle. If I could, I would end it all today. There's a fire that keeps on burning all along the Western world. Another chief that won't be turning. Another war.
That was Anubis Spire with Western Wall from the album Children of a Foreign Faith. For more information, you can check out www.anubisspire.com. On Sunday, 19th of September, Andy Haig Quintet will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Tuesday, 21st of September, AC Slade and the Dark Party will be performing with support from the Lost Souls Club and also Riot Noise at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I understand you were feeling a bit groggy today, but you made it in anyway. But hopefully you will be well for next week.
Thank you.
Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Our studio guest was Chris Worthington. Features were by Tony Gosling, Anthea Page and myself. Malcolm Greaves read Secrets and Lies, Trevor Carter read us one of his poems, and Jeff Sparks presented his What's On guide. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce. The producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me for this week.
And myself, John Peters Coleman. Goodbye.